The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Donna Gerson, and I'm a proud member of the Free Library Foundation's Board of Directors. The Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. Tonight's lecture and many other thought-provoking programs that stimulate active civil dialogue are made possible only through private support from viewers like you. So, the library is a free-to-all resource serving the needs of 10 million in-person and online visits annually, providing a variety of educational and cultural opportunities for people of all ages, regardless of their where they live and what they do. Thank you for considering making a critical gift to the Free Library, especially as we come to the end of the calendar year. And if you go on the Free Library website, there's a donate button at the top of the page, and I urge you to use it. Your library card, and I brought mine with me, and I hope all of you have a library card, is free, but it has tremendous value. So pay it forward with a donation to the Free Library and support the institution that stands for literacy, learning, and civil discourse for all citizens. So it's now my great pleasure to introduce Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. After beginning, After beginning her career as a lawyer in New York City, she turned to public office and spent 2 years as a U.S. representative for New York's 20th Congressional District before being elected the junior senator from New York in 2009. During her decade in national politics, she has collaborated on the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a policy that banned gay and lesbian Americans from serving openly in the military, and championed ethics reform by writing the Stock Act, preventing members of Congress from trading stocks based on non-public information. Born and raised in upstate New York, she is also the author of the 2015 New York Times bestseller, Off the Sidelines, Speak Up, Be Fearless, and Change Your World, encouraging women to make their voices heard. Gillibrand's new book, Bold and Brave, 10 Heroes Who Won Women the Right to Vote, profiles courageous visionaries who raised their voices for justice, and with illustrations by the New Yorker contributor and artist Myra Kalman, Bold and Brave introduces children and adults to these suffragists on the eve of the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. So, we are so pleased to have her with us tonight, and here she is, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
Thank you so much. Oh, lovely. Well, it is a true delight to be here, and I'm so grateful for that introduction and for the hospitality. I'm going to read from the book just a few pages, and then I'm going to summarize the rest of it, and then we'll have a conversation. We went backwards. Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? That was said by Inez Mulholland. It was her dying words, and you'll learn a lot more about her in a minute. Bold and Brave, 10 heroes who won women the right to vote. This picture I love because Myra was taking from a photograph. When the women did their march in 1913, they wanted pageantry, so they wore all white. They had garlands, they had floats, they wore crowns, and it was all about showing that women are beautiful and are still this ideal, but they still wanted a voice and they wanted the right to vote. Our first page is a very significant page, mostly because that dog on the right is my dog, Maple. And now I'll start the book. When I was a little girl, after church on Sundays, I would visit my great-grandmother, Mimi. She told me about a time when women like her left their homes and worked in factories, making equipment to help American soldiers win the war. Mimi taught me to be bold and to believe there was nothing I couldn't do. Mimi's oldest daughter was my grandmother, Polly. She liked to roller skate down the long marble hallways of the New York State Capitol where she worked. When I was about 10, Grandma took me to a big room where ladies stuffed envelopes with letters urging people to vote. I thought, I want to be just like them someday. Grandma taught me to fight for what I believe in. Grandma's oldest daughter was my mom, Penny. She always did what she set her mind to. She was a sports writer for her student newspaper, even though girls were not allowed in the press boxes. She went on to law school and was one of only three women in her class. As a mom, she also earned her black belt in karate, something few women at the time aspired to. My mother taught me you needed to be brave to forge a new path. Who taught my mom and her mom and her mom to be bold and brave so they could teach me and you? I can tell you who. The women who came before them, women who faced unimaginable challenges. When my grandmother was born, women didn't have the right to vote. That meant they didn't have the power to elect the people who established our country's rules and laws. Less than a century later, I became a United States Senator, which means I helped make those laws. Here are 10 women who paved the way. They were called suffragists. Not because they suffered, although they most certainly did, but because suffrage means the right to vote. They fought so women could be heard. So our first suffragist was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and her advice to us is dare to be different. And that was her advice because she had a very different childhood. She lost her big brother when she was really young, and her father was so heartbroken, she decided the best way to console him was to be like a boy. And so she learned how to do all the things that boys learn how to do. She learned how to play chess. She learned how to ride a horse. She learned how to speak Greek. And her dad was a lawyer, and he'd tell her about the laws, and she realized as a young girl that women had no rights under the law. And so she had the first convention in Seneca Falls where she decided she wanted to make sure that women could get the right to vote. Now, that was a very radical idea at the time, but she believed all men and women are created equal, and that was in her statement of sentiments. This was in 1848, and she would not be alone in her journey. Myra depicts the women young and older because they started their efforts when they were very young. She was in her early 30s with lots of little kids, but she worked for 50 years, so she did it her whole life. Our next suffragist was Susan B. Anthony. She started out focusing on abolition, getting rid of alcohol, and temperance, because she believed as a Quaker that abolition was against God, it was a sin to have slavery, but she also believed that temperance was important because she believed if you could get rid of alcohol, you could get rid of violence against women in the home. When she first met Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Elizabeth said to her, you need to add suffrage because if women have the right to vote, you can accomplish both of these things. And so she did. She'd show up to Elizabeth's house. She would help Elizabeth watch the kids, cook and clean, and do all the things that Elizabeth had to do every day. And Elizabeth would sit down and write the speeches. They said about the ladies at the time that Elizabeth would forge the thunderbolts and Susan would fire them. And so they had this amazing partnership. In 1872, Susan voted illegally. Anne was arrested. They fined her $1. She refused to pay. When they actually passed the 19th Amendment, they called it the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. Our next suffragist was Sojourner Truth. Now, Sojourner was born into slavery. She had a very hard life, but she was very faith-driven, and she believed that God wanted her to speak out and to talk about justice. She was named Isabella Bomfrey, but as soon as she escaped from slavery, she renamed herself. She chose Sojourner as someone who travels from place to place and Truth as the center of her faith. She said the truth is powerful and will prevail. Her peers at the time were Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And she believed that her job was to talk about why women's rights matter for black women and white women. She was the first woman to actually talk about intersectionality and how important it was to make sure all women were represented. Our next suffragist was Harriet Tubman. She also was born into slavery. She had a horrible childhood. She was abused as a child. She was beaten as a child. She was hit in the head with such force. She had headaches her whole life.
She escaped from slavery when she was quite young with one of her children, and instead of enjoying her safety and her freedom, she felt so compelled to go back over and over again to free more slaves, and it was all about empathy for her. She said, "I have heard their groans and sighs and seen their tears, and I would give every drop of blood in my veins to free them." So she was courageous. She was very faith-driven. She looked at women of the Bible to show her that women could be strong and courageous. During the Civil War, she was a spy and an armed scout. And after the Civil War and after abolition was achieved, she joined the suffrage movement and started traveling around the country giving speeches. Someday, with a new president, she will be on the $20 bill. Our next suffragist was Jovita Idar. Jovita was born in Texas. Mexican Americans had no rights at the time. Mexican American women were not educated. Her father owned a printing press. When people came to burn it down because he was speaking out against poor treatment of Mexican Americans, she stood in the doorway and made sure they did not burn down her father's printing press. She ultimately took it over. She became an advocate for equality, but also for education for Mexican American children. The schools didn't have books, they didn't have pencils, they didn't have heat, and so she really thought that education was the gateway to opportunity. She said that educate a woman and you educate a family. Our next suffragist is Alice Paul. She was a second generation suffragist. She was very well educated from an affluent family. She went to England so that she could get an advanced degree, and she noticed when she was in England that the suffrage movement there was very different. They were disruptors, and they really were trying to disrupt the status quo in every way they could imagine. They would throw bricks into windows to disturb meetings of parliament. They would sneak into meetings by hiding somewhere in the building or on the roof the day before the meeting so they could sneak in. They would give speeches. They would march. They had colors. And she thought, I'm going to join this movement. She joins the movement in England. She gets arrested. She goes on a hunger strike. She is force-fed. She never really recovers from that, never ate normally again. But this picture that Myra draws is so effective because you can see she's being lifted off her feet entirely by these police officers who are trying to arrest her, but she's still speaking out. Her voice is still being heard, and that really is emblematic of who she was. When she comes to America, she said, I'm going to shake things up. The first thing she does is plan a parade. And our next suffragist is Inez Mulholland, the one who made those very important statements. She rode at the front of the parade. She was from upstate New York. She was a lawyer. She worked on workers' rights. And she was also very beautiful. And what Alice noticed at the time is we need the face of suffrage to be beautiful. We need to show American men and women that women are still women, but that their voice was really important. And so she put Inez right at the front. Inez wore this amazing outfit with this crown of hope, the star of hope on her head, a beautiful white horse named Grey Dawn. And the parade watchers were not kind to the suffragists. They spit on them, they yelled at them, they called them names, they jostled them. They tried to shut the parade down, but she was never afraid. She's right at the front and kept parting the crowds to make sure the women could march. Because of her extraordinary abilities at speaking and advocacy and her smarts and beauty, Alice said after the parade, you have to travel the country. You are now the face of suffrage. And she did. But unfortunately for Inez, she had a blood disorder, something like leukemia, and she just got weaker and weaker and weaker. And she'd write home and say, Alice, I need to come home. This is too hard. I'm really very ill, and I have to come back to regain my strength. And Alice kept persisting, keep going, Inez, keep going. You are making a difference. Sure enough, her last words were, Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? And she fainted and then died. So her voice was important in life and in death. Our next suffragist was Ida B. Wells, who also marched in that parade despite racist objections. A lot of the white women, particularly white women in the South, did not want black women marching because they didn't want to alienate the white women or the white Southern voters. She didn't care. She'd been fighting discrimination her whole life. The picture on the right is when she had a first-class ticket for a train ride. She was in the ladies' section, but she was dragged off the train by the conductor. And what I love about this picture, because you know, children are reading this book and they're going to learn things from this, everyone's yelling at this woman, everybody in the car, the women, the men, and she's holding her ground. You could see she's steadfast in her position, wearing white as the center of truth. And she perseveres. She sues the conductor. She wins in court. She was overturned on appeal. But it was the beginning of her advocacy, and she became an investigative journalist. She traveled all across the South, and she wrote about lynchings, and she was one of the first female investigative journalists. She marched in that 1913 parade. She founded women's groups called, one in Chicago, the Alpha Suffrage Club. She helped found the NAACP, as well as the National Association of Colored Women. And she believed that the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. Our next suffragist was Lucy Burns, who was best friends with Alice Paul, also studied in London at the same time. That's where they met. She helped plan the parade. After the parade, they decided, let's create protests outside the White House, the first advocacy group ever to do that. And they decided to hold banners. Of course, their banner said, Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? And Woodrow Wilson was angry and was very concerned that these women were protesting, especially during wartime, so they started to arrest them. And Lucy was arrested more than any other suffragist, so she spent the most time in that jail. But she believed that persistence is powerful. Our last suffragist is Mary Church Terrell, who also marched to the 1913 parade and was a silent sentinel and stood with Lucy Burns outside the White House. Her advice to us is to stand together, because she continued the legacy of Sojourner Truth and talked about intersectionality, talking about how hard it is for black women because they're knocking on the bar of justice, being discriminated against because they are women and because they're black. And so she made the case that we have to praise the valiant service of those black women because they are enduring that much more than anyone else. She founded the Delta Sigma Theta sorority, one of the most prominent historically black sororities, and they marched in the parade. She always believed if we fought together, we would be stronger. And so her advice to us is stand together. I finished the book with a beautiful picture of the Women's March from 2017, right after the inauguration of President Trump. And what I love about this picture is that Myra leaves all the signs blank. And so when I'm speaking with children, I've done about 15 schools, I ask the young kids, what does your sign say? What would you march for today? And sharing that story with young girls particularly is fascinating, because their signs are amazing and the things they care about are really diverse. There is an issue of age, though. Younger girls, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, they will raise their hands, so excited to tell you, they'll forget the minute you call on them, but then they'll raise their hand again and tell you. When the girls get a bit older, they are silent. They are afraid. And so when they get to be 12, 13, 14, crickets. And it's great when you have a whole bunch of girls, young and old, because then you can shame the older girls with the younger girls. And then I play them off each other and say, you're not as brave as the kindergartners or the first graders. And they eventually participate. But it's a wonderful lesson for them. And our final slide is just suffragists of yesterday and the suffragists of today. And that it includes all of us. So thank you so much. So now we're going to reset, and we're going to have a conversation and then take your questions.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Tracy Matisak. I am delighted to be here with Senator Gillibrand. How about giving her a warm round of applause for sharing her book with us? And if I'm not mistaken, a happy belated birthday is in order as well.
Thank you.
You just had a birthday
last weekend.
Recently.
I did.
Very good. All right. On that note, then, I've got some questions for Senator Gillibrand, but we've budgeted some time for your questions as well. So I'd encourage you to maybe jot down a note if something comes to mind, and we'll make some time for your questions as well. But Senator, thank you for writing this book, and particularly for young readers. I'm curious why you decided to aim this book at younger readers.
So I was asked to do the project by Random House because I'd written off the sidelines, and I got a call about a year and a half ago and said, would you consider writing a children's book on the history of suffrage? And I said, oh, I would love to do that. And it was interesting because I was working on a piece of legislation at the time with the other women senators to pass a centennial commission so we would have resources to give to libraries and schools about the history of suffrage, like we did the Bicentennial Commission to celebrate 1776 in 1976. And I was about 10 then, and I remember the Freedom Train coming through Albany, New York. Does anybody remember the Freedom Train? Well, it was all funded by the Bicentennial Commission to talk about that. So we wanted to have the same thing. And so I had already been traveling around my state talking to going to see the sites that related to suffrage. I went to Seneca Falls. I went to Harry Tubman's house. I went to Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house and saw her father's library with all his law books. I went to Susan B. Anthony's house and saw where she was arrested after she voted. So I had a good idea of some of these stories. And I bought books everywhere I went. And so when I got asked to do the projects, I said, oh, I would love to do this. I already have the materials. So I started reading all the biographies. And the more I read the biographies, I was thinking, this does not sound like a children's book. These stories are really, really violent in some ways and not happy stories. It's about racism. It's about sexism. And I was like, how am I going to possibly tell this story to little kids? But they said, no, we know this will work. And so I just plunged in. And when I got Myra to be my illustrator, I knew it would work out because her pictures, in my opinion, just bring every story to life. And so I think it makes all the difference. So this is what they wanted to do. And I just was a willing participant. And it was a joy. And I chose these 10 women because these are the 10 women that inspired me the most. These are the 10 women that did things that were so cutting edge, so uncommon for their time and their state in life that I wanted to highlight their bravery and courage. Yeah.
You just mentioned as you were doing all of that reading and how difficult some of the subject matter was that you were exploring, I had the sense as I listened to you reading through the book that in some ways the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right.
Yeah, and I just wondered if that occurred to you as you did it, if, you know, seeing parallels between the things that happened back then and what we're seeing today.
Correct. So I thought, you know, for a young reader, boys and girls, that they might not know how hard it was, number one. They may not know how important that right to vote is, what it would be actually like if you didn't have it. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to know that despite all odds, these women persevered and that they never gave up and they kept fighting regardless of how hard it was and the fact that no one necessarily was helping them or wanting them to succeed. And I think for a young reader, they can see themselves in that story. There's something that they might have an ambition to do that seems really, really hard, but having a role model of someone who did something really brave before you only gives you more hope for your own future. I started the book with a little bit of biography because I imagine when moms and dads are reading these books, this book to their kids, they'll have their own heroes in their family, their own grandmother or great-grandmother who did extraordinary things, or grandfathers. And so it just opens up that conversation, I think, in families to talk about bravery in their own lives.
I was also struck as you were talking about the blank signs and how you ask the children what would be on their signs and how the younger ones are very enthusiastic and the older ones not so much. And it made me think about the many studies that have been done that talk about how girls tend to lose their confidence, that they start out when they're young and they're full of confidence and excitement, and then somewhere along the way, we tend to lose it. And I wonder why you think that is and what we need to do to fix that.
I think it's puberty. And I think when you reach that age of 10, 11, 12, you become very self-conscious about how you look, how you sound, what people are judging you on. And I do think for girls particularly, they just become so self-conscious. And they just they're concerned that they're not smart enough or interesting enough or whatever, not enough. And so it's an important thing for parents to know is that we just have to keep assuring our children that your voice really does matter. And I think that's what this book does for me. It tells every reader that your unique voice, what you see, how you feel is important and needs to be shared. So I do think we as society need to keep drawing that out of our young kids, that their voices do matter and that they are the future. And what they fight for is what's going to matter when they're older.
Speaking of voices that matter, this has been a huge year for women politically, especially looking at the results of the midterms. So many women now who will be joining you in Congress. I think it was something like 35 new female members or somewhere around there.
120 women ran for Congress and won.
Yeah.
You had a bunch from Pennsylvania. Thank you so much. And, you know, the whole point of diversity is just so that we can have all the issues raised. I mean, if Congress is just white and male, all the issues that a community faces won't necessarily be raised. So having diversity, having gender diversity, racial diversity, religious diversity, ethnic diversity, socioeconomic diversity, it matters because you're just going to see the world differently. And when you bring that life experience to the table, you'll not only raise different issues, but you'll offer different solutions. And I'll give you one example. When I first started out of Congress, I was on the Armed Services Committee as a House member, and Gabby Gifford sat next to me, and we would raise issues that were different than our male colleagues were raising. And so we'd have a hearing, for example, on something like military readiness, and our male colleagues would very effectively cover, you know, how many ships, how many guns, how many aircraft, you know, what is the hardware we're going to actually acquire and build to be ready. And for my part, and Gabby was similarly like-minded, we were worried about the troops. And so we'd say, well, why is the divorce rate the highest it's ever been? Why is the domestic violence rate the highest it's ever been? Why is the suicide rate the highest it's ever been? And so we just looked at military readiness from the other side of the coin. It's both hardware and making sure of the equipment, but it's also, are the personnel doing okay? And how do you make them military ready? So the combination of both of our areas of concern made for just a stronger hearing on the topic of military readiness. And that's why I've always been a proponent that, you know, we want to have a Congress that reflects all of America. And if we do, we'd have very different issues raised and very different solutions offered.
Yeah. So your name has been mentioned as a potential presidential candidate in 2020. Anything you'd like to say about that tonight?
Well, you know, it's obviously a very important question, and it's for me personally, I think it's a moral question. I believe that there is right versus wrong, and up until this last election, I believe that wrong was winning. And what President Trump has done, as far as what I can see in my state, as I traveled around my state to all 62 counties and did 16 town halls, what I saw was the division of every group, just the constant hate being spewed into our communities, increase in hate crimes, anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and it's tearing our communities apart, and it's destroying the social fabric of our country. And so given that, I feel very much called to fight as hard as I possibly can to restore that moral integrity, that moral compass, that moral fiber of who we are as Americans, because our country's always believed that we should care about one another. We've always believed in the golden rule that we should treat others the way we want to be treated, and that I should care about your kids as much as I care about my own. And so my decision is just going to be whether I can do that best in the Senate or whether I should do that as a presidential candidate, and that's something I will think long and hard about over the next several weeks and months to decide. But I do think we're all called to do something, and to fight in whatever way we can to restore what's right. And I just have to decide how I'm going to do that, because I very much feel like I have to put everything into fighting for what's right.
Yeah. So you mentioned a lot of issues in that response. And I'm wondering, as you go into 2019, what do you think will be your top legislative priority?
So part of the thing that, you know, I just got reelected to my Senate seat this year, and as part of my going to all 62 counties and talking to voters, the stuff that people are worried about are the things that, frankly, every family worries about, the stuff that you talk about at the kitchen table, the stuff you talk about Sunday night or Sunday morning at your favorite diner. Like, it's basic life and death stuff. So people want health care as a right, not a privilege, because if you don't have it, everything changes. If your son or daughter is diagnosed with a disease or has cancer, if your mother is dying of anything, your whole mind, I mean, we know this as humans, everything is determined about whether the people you love are healthy and have what they need. And so this whole issue of getting access to basic health care is a life or death issue. So access to health care is a right and not a privilege. Something as simple as education. I mean, we get very frustrated when our public schools are crumbling and doing terribly, or when college is so expensive it's out of reach, or that there's not enough affordable daycare slots in your community. So education, just again, is a right, not, you know, not just for the privileged. So affordable daycare, universal pre-K, better public schools, affordable college. Again, it's the kitchen table stuff. And then last, but definitely not least, the economy affects everybody. So getting the skills that you need to have a good job is what everybody wants. They just want better job training. They want to earn more. They want to be able to earn their way into the middle class. They want to have a hope at the American dream. And I just feel like this generation is the first one that believes the American dream is not for them, and that believes that perhaps it's not going to be there for their children. And so that means shaking things up, just like Alice Paul said, that you're going to have to disrupt the status quo. You're going to have to change these levers of power that are determined to not make it possible for people to earn their way into the middle class. Yeah. And so you need leadership for that, and you need a vision. And so those are the things that I want to work on over the next 2 years for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of being a disruptor, you took some heat over the Al Franken situation. There were people who accused you of rushing to judgment, turning on a fellow Democrat. There were those who said, oh, I'm not so sure that I want to support this person because I'm not happy about the way that turned out. Do you feel that you've paid a price for that, or that it could cost you in a potential 2020 run?
Well, the issue with Al Franken was very sad. You know, many of us were very close to Al and really appreciated his leadership in the Senate. But unfortunately, there were 8 credible allegations of groping, and 8 is a lot. And what a lot of people didn't appreciate is that the 8th allegation was a Senate staffer who worked for a Democratic colleague. So these weren't setups, these weren't fake, and those allegations were never denied by our colleague to us. You know, he never said this didn't happen. And so I just got to a point where 8 was enough and I could no longer stay silent. So my choice was really this: either stay silent and not do my job as someone who not only fights against sexual harassment and sexual assault in the military and sexual assault on college campuses, or just continue to stay silent and do nothing. Senator Franken was entitled to whatever due process he wanted. He could have stayed, he could have done his ethics investigation, he could have sued every woman who made an allegation against him. Those were his decisions, he chose not to do that. My decision was to not stay silent. I also have boys. I have 2 boys, one's 15 and one's 10. And the conversations I was having at home with Theo at the time were really disturbing. Theo said, Mom, why are you being so tough on Al Franken? And I said, Theo, you may not grope a woman anywhere in her body without her consent, ever. You cannot do it, and Al Franken can't do it. So I know some people are upset because they miss Al Franken. We all miss him. But to blame a woman who decides to speak her mind as the reason that he's no longer serving the Senate is outrageous.
It was around the time of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings that President Trump, I believe, said he was concerned for, he was afraid for his sons. And there was some talk about men expressing concern about their sons being perhaps wrongly accused, being on the other end of this. And you just mentioned that you have 2 sons of your own. And I'm wondering, how do you have concerns about that and how you talk to them about that?
So, you know, I work in this space quite a lot. So for our kids, it's really important to teach our kids about consent and about healthy relationships. What does a healthy relationship actually look like? What does consent look like? What does it mean? And you need to teach children about these issues in an age-appropriate way, starting in grade school. When you start teaching them sex ed in 4th and 5th grade, these are conversations that schools have with their children in an age-appropriate way that are really important. Because I think, you know, it's important to value everyone. We want to value all our classmates. We want to value boys and girls the same. But no one in this country, and certainly no one in this space, would ever want somebody falsely accused and would no way want a system that doesn't have due process and a way for these cases to be properly looked at. The bill that a lot of Senate colleagues and I have been working on for a while has about 35 co-sponsors, half are Republican, half are Democrat, about half. And what we're trying to do on a college campus setting is have better training. Because right now, when you have an allegation of sexual assault on a college campus, some schools don't train the people who are adjudicating these cases. The second thing we want is a survey. We want to be able to have a survey where every college kid in America can fill it out and say, do they feel safe on their college campus? Have they ever been assaulted? If so, did they report? If not, why didn't they report? That would give every school in America a snapshot of basic facts about, is this a safe campus? And if there are a lot of assaults and no one's reporting them, they'll be able to know why. Why is this an impediment in our process? Is our health center just not a welcoming place? Do people not know where to go? And so they can fix it. The third thing our bill would do is create a memorandums of understanding with law enforcement. Because if you have a serial rapist on campus, you want that case to go to law enforcement because you need jail time. You don't need to expel a student. They need to go to jail if they're a serial rapist. And so you want to have a relationship with the law enforcement. So if a survivor feels she can or he can, they can go to the police. A lot of local law enforcement doesn't take student cases seriously, sadly. In fact, John Krakauer wrote an amazing book called Missoula on that very topic that if you're interested in the topic, you should read it. So you want law enforcement to take these cases seriously. And then the third thing is you want confidential advisors on campus for both the accused and accuser so that there's a one-stop shop, some place you can go to get basic information if you're being accused or if you want to make a case. And so if we could pass that kind of legislation, you would get rid of the kangaroo courts we have on these college campuses where, I mean, you may not know this, but in some schools, there's a separate adjudication system if the accused is an athlete. So, and that decision gets made by the athletic department. So if your person that's accused is a star, whatever player, I promise you, you're not going to get transparency and accountability because the value is placed on the player, not the survivor. And so we're just trying to change that. So we want to have a better adjudication system that's driven by facts. And then the question a lot of people who don't know much about this space will say immediately, why would anything ever been done on a campus? Why does it go straight to law enforcement? If there's a crime, it needs to go to law enforcement. The truth is that law enforcement doesn't necessarily take these cases serious, number one. Number two, an 18-year-old kid isn't necessarily going to want to spend the next 2 years going through a trial and giving their life over to the criminal justice system. So they'll be afraid, so they won't report. And it's one of the reasons why sexual assault is the most least reported crime in America, because there's just so much fear that you'll be blamed, that you're afraid of the process. And so what a school needs is a process, because most of these cases, the survivor just wants an accommodation, meaning she wants to change her dorm room. She wants to change her class schedule. She doesn't want to sit next to her assailant in science class. She might need to take a semester off. And so that's the kind of thing a school can do, but they can't accommodate you unless they know some set of facts. And so the process is just to be able to come up with a set of facts about what they think happened. And if they really believe that the person accused is guilty, they might expel them. But I can promise you, at Stanford, they expel you faster for not paying your tuition or cheating on a test. And they have never expelled anybody for sexual assault. And I can promise you, they are not a campus without sexual assault. So we're just bad at this. We're very bad at it. And so a campus, if they do want to get rid of a predator, they just need a process. They rarely use it anyway. But it's mostly for accommodation, because law enforcement can't accommodate your class schedule. They can't change your dorm room. Yeah. They can't help you in that way. They can send someone to jail. And for most survivors, they don't even want that outcome. They just don't want to have to sit next to the person ever again. Yeah. So that's why this it's a lot of work. It's hard. It's the military's worse. The military at least has the survey. The greatest thing the military does is have this survey every 2 years. And so we know there were an estimated 15,000 cases of sexual assault, unwanted sexual contact, and rape in the military last year. We know that 4,000 people reported openly naming their assaulter. We know 2,000 cases reported confidentially. We know that those numbers really haven't changed in the last 5 years. We also know that the rate of retaliation for somebody that comes forward hasn't changed. It was 62% 2 years in a row. Last year it was 59%. So it's not getting better. So our solution there is to let the decision be made by someone outside the chain of command who doesn't have a skin in the game and has no reason to protect one of the service members over the other, which is the current situation.
You tweeted a week or two ago that the future is female. And there was some backlash around that because there was a group of people that said, well, does that mean that men and boys don't matter or what does that mean? So clarify for us what that tweet means. Yeah. I mean, you've got a husband, you've got two sons.
It just means that we hope the future can have more than just white men. That's all. It's supposed to be more inclusive. So it's not supposed to be exclusive, because why would you just want women in the future? You want everybody in the future. They're the ones being excluded today, though. We only have 20% of women in Congress. It is not enough. What you want, again, back to my Gabby Gifford story, what you want is the Congress to reflect the population of the American people. And so, you know, I have a gym shirt that says, the future is females running, because you just want more women to say, I'm tough enough, smart enough, capable enough to serve in Congress or as mayor or on the school board. Because right now, a lot of women don't run. It's not the thing they often do to be heard. They would rather serve in the background. They'd rather serve as support staff. They'd rather serve in a not-for-profit or a charity. They don't like the nastiness of campaigns and all the negative ads. So this election was the first time so many women got to the point where they said, I will not endure this anymore. If no one will run, I will run. Mm-hmm. I will be the one to change the outcome. And that's why 120 women ran for Congress and won. We're still, I think we're 22% now. Like, we have so far to go. So the purpose of it was just an aspirational statement. Mm-hmm. Like, we hope more women keep running because we want diversity. We want the future to look like the rest of America. Because, again, the synergies of men and women together, of people of color, people of different backgrounds, people of different religious backgrounds, is strong. And it makes for better outcomes when everyone's included in those really important conversations about the future of the country.
Yeah. Well, on that note, what do you say we take your questions and comments for Senator Gillibrand? We've got some staff members who have microphones, so yeah, just raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone to you. Yes, ma'am, right here.
Senator, thank you for coming. What do you think of what Betsy DeVos is doing about sexual abuse on campus?
Nothing. She is doing nothing. So Betsy, unfortunately, wants to unwind Title IX. Title IX is our protection to make sure you get access to an equal education regardless of your race or your gender or your background. And so she does not want to enforce Title IX. In fact, she's changed the rules so if you are accused of sexual assault that you can file your own case against the school for discrimination on gender. So she's basically saying if a man is accused or a woman's accused of sexual assault that they're just being discriminated against by their gender. What she doesn't realize is there's not a there's not an overwhelming number of cases where white men are being discriminated against because of their gender. There is an overwhelming number of cases of women who do not come forward who are sexually assaulted and are disbelieved and then retaliated against when they do come forward. So the problem we're trying to change is the fact that campuses aren't safe for everyone. We don't have a rash of cases of white male discrimination. We just don't. And so it's just a lack of recognition of the reality of the world today and that sexual assault cases are the least reported cases of all violent crimes in America today. And it's really hard to bring cases and result in conviction. The only ones that really work are the DA's offices that are really specialized. So the Manhattan DA's office brings an overwhelming number of cases forward and I think has a conviction rate above 50%. The military has a conviction rate of 2%.
Wow. That's staggering.
And college campuses is less than 2%, just so you know. Like it's not, there's just, we don't have the problem. False accusations are estimated between 2 and 5%. It's just very rare. And just imagine how, I mean, just look how Dr. Blasey Ford was treated. Do you think people would willingly want to come forward? No, they really don't because it is so painful. Number one, to relive the worst moment of your life publicly. But number two, rarely are you believed and rarely do you get justice. So why would you? And that's the problem we're dealing with. So we're trying to make it just possible for safety on campus.
Staying on topic in terms of education.
We have 10 suffragists who I want to talk about.
Well, I work in higher education, and I have a question about student loan debt and what is being done to help relieve student loan debt and loan repayment assistance. I see this as a huge crisis for this generation of students.
Yeah, so one of the obvious and easy things we could do is let anyone with a federal student loan refinance at the going Fed window rate. So that's about 4%. So it would be the quickest fix, simplest thing just to say all federal debt is refinanced at 4% immediately. It would put $15 billion straight back into the economy. And it would be a middle class tax cut, which Republicans don't believe you have to pay for. So it'd be really perfect. So that's a great bipartisan idea that I wish we could put forward and actually vote on. But I think, so that's one thing, and I think we have to just make it easier for college to be accessible. I think the future of education does need to be reimagined. I think higher ed can be imagined as more of pipeline job training, offering coursework at community colleges and state schools that fit the job openings in the community. And I'll give an example. When Bombardier in upstate New York needed advanced welders, they went to the local community college, said, offer this coursework, we will hire your graduates, and it's a $70,000 a year job. It works perfectly. Mm-hmm. Perscola, a not-for-profit educational institute in the Bronx, decides we want to make sure young adults in the Bronx can have access to STEM education so they can get really high-paying jobs in STEM fields. That meant, you know, teach them how to build a computer, how to fix a computer, how to code, how to create gaming, how to do cybersecurity. They've already trained and placed 800 young adults into jobs because they offer the coursework for free in the areas where there are jobs open. And so that, I think, we can reimagine education in the future for more skills training delivered through our communities, colleges, and state schools, either for low cost or no cost, depending on the industry. Perscola is entirely funded. It's a not-for-profit. And the young adults that go there do not pay a dime, and they get the skills training they need. So they are now taxpayers. They are in industries that are growing and that have an opportunity for higher pay. So that's how they earn their way into the middle class. So I can reimagine some ideas about how to give more affordable education to more people.
Thank you for coming. Many of us are sitting here, and we're very glad to hear you read from the book, but are also looking at you as a potential presidential candidate. And it's within that dual context that I ask this question. If Tracy were writing about the 11th hero, and that was you, what would you like to be in the book about where you've stood up, where you've been bold, where you've been brave, where you've really made a difference, and you want the world to know about what it was that was so important that you did?
So there's a couple of things that I think took a lot of bravery that I was afraid that I wouldn't be successful in, but I persevered anyway. The first thing I was asked to do when I became a senator was lead the 9/11 health bill. And it hadn't even had a hearing in the Senate. It had been in the House of Representatives sitting dormant for 7 years, and it already had 20 hearings. And so it wasn't moving. And so as a freshman senator, my job was to speak for these first responders. And I didn't know how to do it, so I asked for advice from other female senators, and the best advice I was given at the time was from my friend from Louisiana, and she said, "You have to tell people why you care." And so not only did I then sit with the first responders and hear how hard their lives were because they did the courageous thing. They answered the call of duty. They raced up towers when people were coming down. They were breathing in toxins while they tried to find survivors and then remains. And so I took their stories to Congress. And not only did we pass the 9/11 health bill once, we passed it twice. And every first responder and community members now have all the health care they need until the day they die. And so that took courage and perseverance and was a lost cause. Nobody thought that bill would ever get passed, but I knew if I could use my voice to speak for them and work with them knocking on the door of justice, knocking on the door of every senator, that we could prevail. Also, as a freshman senator, I took on the cause of gay men and women serving in the military, people who were being disregarded based on who they loved. A cause that had not been accomplished, and no one had the courage to carry that bill at the time. Our greatest ally to fight for men and women in the military who were gay and lesbian was Ted Kennedy, and he was dying of brain cancer. So as a freshman senator, I took the bill, and I said, I'm going to fight for this. President Obama did not believe in me. He said, you're too junior, and you're not on the committee of jurisdiction. I don't want you to be in charge of this bill. And I said, I don't care. So I started working as hard as I could, meeting with senators, Republican senators, Democratic senators. I took it to every Democratic colleague, and Democrats said to me, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this now? And I said to them, people senior to me by decades, civil rights is never convenient. You have to fight for it because you believe in it. And so I fought against my own party. I fought against my own leadership. I fought against my own president. President Obama said, if you lead this, I won't necessarily support it. So I said, I will get the lead senator. And so I started talking to Senator Lieberman. He was the moderate, senior member of the committee that they wanted. And I bugged him every week for 3 months to drop that bill. And so I said to Senator Lieberman, can we drop the bill? We need to drop the bill today. Why aren't we dropping the bill today? Why aren't you? We need to do. And so persistence is powerful, as our suffragists tell us. Very persistent, but also recognizing that maybe I couldn't be out front on this. Maybe I had to play the person behind the scenes pushing it forward, knowing how to get something done, regardless of whether or not I would get the credit, never giving up, and repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell laid the framework for more states to pass marriage equality. Before we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, my state had a vote on marriage equality. It failed. The legislature was not ready. After we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the vote in New York passed marriage equality. Within 5 years, which I told every person in the gay rights movement at the time, we will deliver marriage equality in 5 years. They couldn't believe it. But what I knew was, once you elevate the stories of men and women who will die for this country, that they are worth protecting because they will give everything, I knew I would win that battle, and we did. So there's lots of battles like this where I will stand up for what's right, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. And you can use Al Franken as an example. I can't tell you of a more painful experience. Nobody wanted to speak out. Everybody wanted to stay silent. We wanted to support someone we know and love. But I cannot stand silent when something is wrong, especially when it's hard.
Thank you. No questions? This one.
Hi, I'm wondering when the next, hopefully the next president in 2020 will be a Democrat, perhaps it will be you, and I'm wondering what you think, given the limited bandwidth that a new president has of getting things accomplished, what would be your top three priorities?
Well, I can tell you, just as a senator, my top three priorities right now, regardless of whether I run or not. I think people are struggling, and no matter where I traveled in my state, people just don't see the future with a lot of hope. They see the absolute power of special interests and the way the country's run today as something that does not support them. When President Trump ran on the system's rigged, which is Liz Warren's message, and no bad trade deals, which is Bernie Sanders' message, and build a wall, which is his own hateful, horrible message, he did it purposefully because he ran as the disruptor. And the reason why so many New Yorkers voted for him, Hillary only won the cities. He won all of upstate New York, all of Long Island. Our state was actually red on election day. I won back those counties, most of those counties in my election this year, because people are just struggling. And so what they've told me is they care about basic things like healthcare is a right and not a privilege. So we have to take on the drug companies. We have to disrupt the powerful monopolies of the insurance industry. We need to offer healthcare as a not-for-profit public option, because if we don't, you'll never get to universal coverage and you'll never get to affordability, because you have to take out the fat. You have to take out the massive CEO pay. You have to take out the quarterly profits and shareholder value in favor of aligned synergies that just care about human health. So I want to get closer to universal coverage for everybody. I care about education, the fact that too many kids are going to school in broken schools, the fact that college is out of reach and unaffordable to too many people, the fact that universal pre-K is still a pipe dream for so many communities. I want to make sure everybody has that shot, and I want to change your issue of better job training. I mean, the stories I heard, they're all the same. It doesn't matter. Like, our party's wrong when you say you can't talk about reform with this group but not that group because you need to just go after the, like, that's wrong. People are people, and their challenges are almost the same. The Latina on Long Island who works two jobs, who's a single mom, she leaves her house at 7 a.m. She doesn't get home till 9 p.m. because she has two cobbled together jobs, one $17 an hour, one $16 an hour. So raising the minimum wage does not help her. But she has a special needs son, and she cannot make ends meet. What she needs is better job training so she can get a $25 an hour job that's 9 to 5, so she can be the mom she wants to be. But nobody's supporting her. Democrats haven't talked about solutions for her. So she needs help, but so does the 52-year-old engineer in upstate New York who's been laid off because he's now a high-cost worker, and the low-cost worker who's 25, they can hire for half the price. So we need to create a much better bar for our leaders to reach, because they should be caring about our workers. They should care about the community. They should care about the strength of the U.S. economy, not the quick dollar, not just shareholder value. How about focusing also on the common good? How about creating a country where we believe in our people, reward work again? And so those are the issues that I want to fight for, because those are the issues that New Yorkers spent the most time talking to me about in this last election.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. However, we are out of time. I know we could talk with Senator Gillibrand for a long, long time. She's got to get on her way, but we want to thank you for coming. And again, a warm round
thank
of applause.
Thank you all. God bless
Senator
you all.
Gillibrand.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.